Hi, this is Zach Rogers, and I'm excited to tell you about a new podcast from AdExchanger, hosted by our managing editor, Ryan Joe, and accompanied by a rotating cast of characters from our news reporting team. The podcast will dig into a single major industry development every week, discuss its implications, and make you generally feel smarter about it. Look forward anywhere you get your podcasts starting in July. Thanks very much for listening.
Welcome to AdExchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is brought to you by Telium, the universal data hub that connects your web, mobile, call center, in-store, and other data sources together with every vendor integration. Stay tuned to hear Telium's CMO, Adam Corey, chat with AdExchanger's Zach Rogers about collecting data with a centralized strategy to better know your customers and create more innovative experiences.
Hi, everyone. So investment bankers are usually background deal makers who don't maintain outsized public profiles. Not so my guest this week. Terry Khawaja is one of the stars of digital media and marketing technology. He is known as much for his jokes, musical parodies, goofiness, and of course his Lumascape slides as he is for his M&A work. Although that deal work is prodigious. Terry and his partners have advised on tens of billions of dollars. It's probably more than that in M&A deals like Oracle buying Moat, Singtel buying Turn, Criteo buying HookLogic, Adobe buying Demdex, Neustar buying Aggregate Knowledge, Google buying AdMeld and Invite Media. So really amazing record here. I'm super excited to have him in the studio. Welcome, Terry.
Great to be here, Zach.
Oh, I should also say Terry will be speaking at Exchanger's upcoming Programmatic I.O. conference in New York, October 15th and 16th. Check it out. And with that mandatory plug aside, let's jump in. I'd love to know about your, like, childhood for a minute before we get into, like, the industry. I know, it's a weird question. How to put this? Like, a lot of times you wonder if somebody who's just, like, compulsively funny and telling jokes is compensating for, like, a lack of attention in childhood. Were you one of, like, 30 kids?
So oh, my God. We're going to go deep.
Let's get into it, man.
No. Middle child of three kids. So I can't claim any kind of...
grew up in Ontario?
Yeah, right? Grew up in Toronto. Yeah, born in Quebec. Grew up in on Toronto. Mm-hmm. And... you know, kind of started as an entrepreneur at age 9, actually. Paper Route, which I bought for no money down because the kid was leaving the next day. And so I sort of held him out to the last minute and bought it. And then ended up hiring a bunch of people to run Paper Routes for me and had that gig for 5 years and then sold it and did all kinds of other cool, fun, entrepreneurial things, buying and selling cars, just whatever.
So you got to where you weren't even delivering papers. You were just... You were just like you were the dispatcher for other paper boys.
Well, I started off delivering papers,
Then
I ended up.
You graduated
up sort of
by the age of 11. You were probably
exactly
hiring and firing.
There we go.
Okay. Okay. Good. And then, were you always a joke teller?
Yes. So I like to tell people. People ask me all the time, you know, "What's with the comedy stuff?" And I answer, "Look, three things. Number one is." That's me.
Yeah.
I've been a comedian longer than I've been a banker, and I've been a banker for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a world of authenticity, like, that's me. I would do that anyways. Mm-hmm. I was doing that all through, you know, making deals. So when it comes to authenticity, you know, that's just what it is. I can't fake it.
That's just something you were always going to bring to whatever
exactly.
You did. Right. Okay.
And then
it.
Secondly, there actually is a utility to it. So,
yeah.
So I find that, you know, being the whole, you know, funny side of things, it's a great tool for differentiation, capturing people's attention, their retention, and even delivering sort of tough news or sort of, you know, bad points about an industry. If you can sort of, you know, they say a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. So if you've got sort of a tough message to deliver, comedy can also be a useful tool. Now, I do warn people though that you can't do comedy without having real substance, right? So it's only a companion. You can't just be a comedian. Otherwise,
interesting.
You know,
yeah, right.
You're not going to be taken
seriously.
There
has to be content, or else content marketing sucks.
Correct.
Right. And what that's to some extent is what it is, as you say. Like the parodies and music videos and the humor has helped build the Luma brand. And I love the point about, you know, delivering back bad news this way. I mean, it's true that if you don't laugh, you'll cry with some of the news lately. And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Indeed.
Why did you want to be an investment banker? I mean, was this an aspiration early on for you?
Well, I'm not sure specifically investment banker. I'm one of these guys that did tremendous amount of schooling, probably too much. Uh-huh. Studied economics and then got into a JD MBA program. So I did law and business. And I knew I wanted to be an intermediary in the action. I like the idea of deals. I like the idea of project work. And so that was either lawyer or banker. And I worked a summer at a law firm, said, great, I see what that is. I'd prefer to be one step closer to the principal. Mm-hmm. And so became a banker. And I really enjoy the, you know, advising entrepreneurs and big companies alike, but largely entrepreneurs around, you know, fashioning their outcomes. It's a lot of fun.
And you worked at GCA and Citigroup and Credit Suisse before you founded Luma.
Yeah, I mean, right, I started at Salomon Brothers. I was there for 12 years. I was a partner running their sort of media and communications M&A. So that was, you know, the 90s for me was doing big school media and big school telco M&A. In fact, I describe my career as first half of my career was doing, you know, big media and telco M&A. Second half of my career, all this sort of digital technology companies. And I'm pretty sure the third half of my career is going to be at the intersection of the two.
Okay, interesting. And so you saw the internet coming. Did you give a thought to like, hey, I'm going to be a CFO of a digital media startup and sell the company? Or did you always want to be an advisor?
Well, so I actually did do that for a year.
I
left and joined a client as CFO, took it public, and sold.
Okay,
and I came back to the street because I'm like, okay, been there, done that. And of course, we had the crash in 01, 02. Mm-hmm. So I came back to advisory because I just love deals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. So you found at a certain point you sort of busted out on your own and founded Luma. What motivated you and what were you hoping to do there?
So throughout my career, I've sort of pursued what I call theme-based M&A. So it's not just sort of transactional happenstance, build a couple of relationships and monetize them. Rather, you know, and this dates back to my earliest days, and I credit the senior folks that I worked with for sort of instilling this, was this notion of, you know, looking at an industry, trying to figure out what's going to happen, what are the moves, you know, try and think 3-6 chess moves ahead of time and sort of line yourself up around whether it's a technology change, a business model change, an ecosystem change, and sort of it's trend-based or theme-based M&A. And I found that if you were good and you were able to sort of nail something coming, you could get on the early end of a wave of consolidation and ride it all the way through because whoever was a sort of successful advisor to sort of early deals in the sector often had excellent market share. So I did that with the whole, with radio broadcasting, with cable, the proliferation of cable in the U.S. and the U.K., and then thirdly, the sort of competitive telco. And each one of those sort of subsector trends had like a 6 to 8 year run. Fast forward years later when I saw sort of like the internet proliferating and the explosion of new company formation at a scale that we hadn't seen before, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a 20-year run, not a 6 year run. And so while
what was the clue to you that it was going to, that it had more punch than the others? All the VC flowing in, or was it?
Because that's derivative, right? VCs is a function of something, but the something was the unique characteristics of
the technology itself.
The digital channel and what that can do. Because you look at it, all the spend that takes place, you know, a lot of it's guessing, a lot of it's, you know, based on relationships and smoothing. And when you actually have the data, it's sort of like, you know, no one teaches creationism anymore once they know about, you know, evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like once you could sort of see digital, you know, what worked and how it worked and so much more efficient distribution mechanisms such that it would, A, work better. B, there would be more companies because it's cheaper. New company formation was cheaper. You had AWS. Mm-hmm. And yes, you had the availability of venture capital funds. So if you look at all these industries, they naturally go through a wave of consolidation. Well, you'll get dozens of companies, sometimes, you know, 100 companies will form. And then they'll go through a consolidation wave where it'll cut down to often sort of 4 or 5. Here in digital, and by the way, you know, we saw that in almost every sector, whether it's media or software or data. Here in the sort of digital channel, we saw a proliferation of companies like we've never seen before. I mean, we're not talking dozens or hundreds. We're talking thousands of companies.
Mm-hmm.
We believe, you know, we said, geez, that will naturally consolidate. And when it does, that's plenty of work. And that's why I wanted to sort of dedicate our approach to the marketplace for Luma in digital media and marketing.
The other side of the equation is the buyers, and there have to be enough buyers to consolidate with a certain dollar heft behind them.
That's right.
And you saw that as well early on.
Yeah, saw that. And also now think about that marketplace where you've got massive fragmentation and high growth.
Mm-hmm.
Combine those two things together. What I recognized was the more traditional way of intermediating M&A, which was basically running a sell-side process, an auction to try and gin up, you know, interest in a company, completely falls down. In fact, it's an adverse selection signal. Any strategic that sees a company has hired a bank and they're running a process to sell was usually running, not walking in the other direction. So this notion that,
why?
You know—
Because
you would,
it looks distressed and looks
well,
weak?
Well, if it's a high-growth market, why are you selling?
Right.
If you're not a— You know, if you're truly differentiated and you've got excellent independent prospects, you know, growth prospects as an independent company, why would you proactively decide to sell?
Got it.
So
they look desperate and so they're less.
Exactly. The old adage, right, is it's better to be bought than sold.
Right.
And almost everybody would agree with that statement, but how that manifests itself in terms of the marketplace is very different. Most investment bankers sell companies. We don't. We do what we call strategic matchmaking. We spend—
How does that work?
A lot of time getting to know the companies in the marketplace, the growth companies, figuring out their unique differentiations and capabilities. And then we spend a tremendous amount of time with the buyers in media, in software, in data, in private equity, you know, trying to figure out what they're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're meeting with the buyers, I'm not talking about the execution people in the M&A departments. I'm talking about the
product
people who are either running product in the technology companies.
Neil Mohan at Google. Two of your biggest early deals. You sold companies to Neil.
Exactly. Business unit leaders like Eric Rosa at Oracle. These are people that don't naturally meet with bankers.
Right. So
right?
Why do they want to meet with you?
Well, because there's a value proposition there that is different from just being a banker. The reason why we spend a lot of time thinking about the space, thinking about trends, talking about how we see the market evolving, which manifests itself in our many, you know, reports, some of which you guys, report on, and have gotten tremendous distribution. You know, all of that is to build what we call objective credibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
These guys sort of kind of have a handle, know what they're talking about. And that sort of value exchange is why those large corporates, you know, have us in to talk about what's going on, so much so we actually made a business out of it.
There are things that you could tell Neil Mohan or Eric Rosa that they don't know from their perches at Google and Oracle, for example,
which would be
insights into these companies that you're representing.
Let's be clear, though. They know their company better than anything. It's just that, you know, we talk to everybody, so it's a different lens, right? Think of theirs as being a vertical lens, ours a horizontal lens across the ecosystem. And together, they have found that that's particularly valuable, which is why they have us in.
Mm-hmm.
We speak at their internal events, whether it's Google, Facebook, Oracle, Procter & Gamble. We speak at their company events.
So this is funny. So the companies that hire you, they don't want to run a process because that makes them look desperate, but they still work with you. And what do they want from you? And how do they work with you on the initial engagement?
So over half the 44 deals that we've completed are ones where we identified, you know, we work with the strategic around, given what's going on in the ecosystem, what strategies make sense? And sometimes they'll bounce strategies off us. And then we figure out, okay, what capabilities do you need to accomplish that? that strategy? And given their arsenal of existing capabilities, what are the gaps? Mm-hmm. Should they build, buy, or partner? And if they decide they need to buy, then we help them with target identification.
Right. On the target identification side, though, those the companies that are looking to sell, since they don't want to broadcast that
they're for sale. Well, let me stop you right there. They're not looking. I mean, look, almost every growth company in theory, right, that's taken venture capital is at some point a fiduciary for their investors and therefore, you know, must consider potential exits. But when we are doing target identification, we're not saying these are companies that want to sell. We're saying these are companies that objectively best match the capability gap that you have in order to accomplish the strategy that we agreed would make sense for you to pursue. And so in that context, right, the usual tension between a buyer and a seller is, you know, the seller goes hat in hand to the buyer and the buyer has all the leverage.
Right.
So in this instance, we're identifying an objective match. So when they meet, it's not like the target company is looking to sell. In fact, they're like, okay, I'll entertain a conversation.
So you're more acting as a representative of the strategic buyer.
No, we technically represent, at that time, right, we're sort of consulting with, albeit on an unpaid basis, the buyer, but we represent the target companies 95% of the time.
Yeah, got it. Okay, great. And when you do a meeting or when you're doing target identification, what is the process? What kind of information do you hope to get out of a meeting with a potential target for a buy?
So it's important for us to know what they're doing, how they're doing it, their sort of key differentiation. Because when we're in a meeting with a strategic and they say, okay, we're interested in this category, we need to be able to distinguish between, you know, vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry terms of trying to determine the sort of the best match. By the way, all that process does is identify the default buyer, you know, the initial interested strategic party. We love competition just like everybody else. It's just that we wouldn't suggest you proactively go on the market because that looks desperate. But rather, you know, once you have that sort of default interest, then you can do what we call a market check, where you call the other sort of half a dozen people with whom we know are interested in that category based on our interactions with them previously. And you know, we've done deals. The vast majority of the deals go to the default buyer just because, you know, they've done the advanced work and the like. But sometimes you'll get an instance like Nvidia to AT&T where, you know, that was a set of discussions that started with a completely different company.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, right. All right, great. We're going to take a moment's break and hear from a sponsor. Then we'll be back with Terry Khawaja. Hi, I'm here with Adam Khoury, Chief Marketing Officer at Tealium. Tealium is a sponsor of this episode of AdExchanger Talks, and we're grateful for that. Adam, tell us about Tealium. What's the history there, and how'd you get started?
Sure. So when Tealium started years ago, we were helping companies manage the data that flows to their web analytics applications. And through that, that was really the management of what are called tags, or pieces of JavaScript that transmit data back and forth. And for us, it was always about data. And today, when we fast forward, our platform now includes an API hub that allows companies to take in data from mobile, IoT, from back-end servers, a customer data platform that gives you one place to manage how you understand your visitors, creating audiences, and centralized actions. And all of this together is what we call a universal data hub. It's really about building a data supply chain inside of the organization that allows all of your employees and frontline professionals to create one view of the customer and contribute to creating better experiences.
Talk a little bit more about that. What's a data supply chain?
Yeah. So a data supply chain, if you think about what a supply chain is, it's all about the production of and distribution of something. And that's what we think of as what happens with data inside of organizations. Lots of different teams are responsible for producing data. My marketing team is producing data when someone clicks on a campaign. My product team is creating data when someone engages with their app. And we're all a part of using data to better understand our customer. So we think a data supply chain is all about bringing together at the core an understanding of what our data is that we collect about our customers, and that every team and every tool that's a part of our company should be contributing to that. Because it's really ultimately the customer data at the center of a company. And so we want to make sure that we're contributing to that holistically across the organization.
So you're working with all these data sources as originally a tag management company. So what's a common misconception about collecting data?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the biggest misconception is that I need to think about data based on how that data is handled. So I manage front-end data different than I handle back-end data. I handle batch data differently than I handle tags or APIs. And at the end of the day, this is all customer data about what's happening with an individual. It's describing how they're engaging with your brand. So I need to manage it holistically. I think as tech vendors, we've sometimes made it harder on ourselves by confusing people by calling something a JavaScript API when really it's just a tag. And for us, at the end of the day, it's all about creating that one place where everyone can be a part of the solution and allow us to build really great experiences for customers by leveraging data.
All right. Adam Corey of Tealium, thanks for your support.
Thank you.
And I'm back with Terry. So let's talk about the current environment. M&A consolidation in 2018. What are the headlines there?
So consolidation does continue. I guess that would be the overarching message. We have sensed somewhat of a slowdown of late. I would attribute that to a couple different things. One is GDPR and the whole privacy discussion, which we can get into,
really
does have a potential, you know, significant impact. And the biggest impact immediately is that it's creates uncertainty. And M&A markets, you know, people make, you know, multi-hundred million dollar, billion dollar decisions based on certainty. And so to the extent that there's things that are amorphous or up in the air or uncertain, that tends to give people pause. The second element is, as you're no doubt aware, you know, the big media and telco world is awash right now with pending deals. Mm-hmm. There's over $300 billion in transactions where almost every major media and telco play is sort of in play, right? Disney, Comcast, Fox, CBS, Viacom, AT&T, Time Warner, the list goes on. And those are, yeah, I would describe that as a sort of tectonic plate shifting in that world. And obviously, some of that needs to sort of settle down or be resolved first before people turn their attention to the much smaller, also important, but much smaller, you know, issues of what digital capabilities they'll need to monetize said assets.
Do you think that any of the slowdown is also attributable to just maturity of technology or the reduction in the number of strategics that are interested in shopping?
So, and I guess a third element that's not a this year environment, but it sort of has been coming for some period of time is we are naturally going through a sort of consolidation phase. And if you ever want to, you know, a clue as to where we are, just look at private equity activity. So private equity tends to get involved when an industry is on that down curve, right? We used to always track with the Lumascapes, you know, the number of companies on the Lumascapes, and every year the new company formation, or at least addition to the Lumascape, which has some threshold to it, relative to acquired companies, there was always more companies. It was like whack-a-mole for years. For the first time ever in 2015, that inverted, and we now had a net consolidation. So you know, fewer independent companies. And I think so that's a natural progression where you will see fewer but maybe larger deals.
Okay, got it. So talk about private equity a little bit before we get into some of the privacy and GDPR stuff. We see Vista and Vector and GTCR coming in and buying companies. Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert on PE, but I do know that it's a signal of maturity often in an emerging growth space. And does it suggest that to you that we may be heading for a period of private equity from here on out? Will we see that being the main driver of consolidation over the next 5 years?
Right. So historically, private equity investors look at later stage companies that are profitable. They look to cut costs. They put leverage on them. That's the typical playbook of private equity in the whole period, you know, 3 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. And they look to exit by way of IPO or another trade sale. I think while there's been some of that with companies that are profitable in this sector, in the cases of, say, Vista, and some other investors, it's sort of a hybrid of growth private equity, because they're not necessarily, you know, driving. I mean, they will, I'm certain, drive costs down and maybe put some leverage on it, but that's not really what's going to drive their returns. What's driving their returns is they are acting much more like a strategic, in the sense that they see a trend, they see a business that's got growth characteristics, and they're probably underwriting those investments with the assumption that with some improvements and some continued sort of growth in that capability and that company, that there is in fact a strategic exit. So they're making those investments assuming that these companies in fact will have an audience of strategic buyers a few years down the road. We're by no means done with strategic buying.
Let's talk about the history of strategic buying, because the early wave was the portals.
Correct.
AOL and Yahoo. And
yeah, it was sort of like the media-centric companies. Mm-hmm. It then migrated to the sort of the marketing clouds. We're now in a wave where it's marketing clouds have sort of, you know, a lot of them have garnered their capabilities. They're not done, though. There are more marketing clouds now. There's a half a dozen of them, and there are still more capabilities that they require.
They're not moving fast, except for Oracle.
Right. Well, some of them are on pause, although, you know, SAP made three major acquisitions in the last year.
SAP and Oracle are super busy. Salesforce is willing to, like, snipe targets sort of opportunistically, or if Oracle buys something and they feel like they've got to have one. And then we also kind of have IBM and Adobe kind of constantly hovering as possible, you know, buyers in the space.
So right.
Do you see, is there anything simmering right now with that crowd?
Yeah, they're always looking at capabilities. And there's a lot more capabilities that logically could fit given what their broader marketing cloud parameters and objectives are. But I would put that in the sort of usual suspect strategic category. Then there's also new entrants. And I largely gauge the health of a sector on the basis of new entrant activity.
I mean,
this year we saw Pandora buy AdsWizz. And it wasn't the biggest deal in the world, but we are talking to media companies looking at the sector, retail companies, commerce companies looking at capabilities in the sector, even some other categories of buyers. And there's a reason why we get that advanced look, right? Because people looking at this sector, often they find their way to a Lumascape, right? And then as they study it and look at it, they see it's very complex and they don't want to make mistakes. And often we get an early phone call. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we were working with Telenor, a telco from Norway that no one had ever heard of, mm-hmm. 18 months, you know, before they bought Tapad. So often we'll get an advanced lens into who's thinking about the sector. We work with them to help educate them, help, you know, them sort through strategies and ultimately targets, which is what leads to deal flow.
Right. And you mentioned telcos. I mean, that was the third wave of strategics, you know, AT&T, Verizon, Telenor, Singtel, and some others, I think. Is there a fourth wave?
I think we'll see some interesting and scaled retail retail companies certainly explore. I mean, look at Amazon has largely built their capabilities, but they see a huge business in advertising. And one of the things we talked about in our sort of State of Digital Media that we just published was this notion that, you know, as everyone sort of has come to realize now, is that while Amazon number five or six right now in terms of revenue in digital advertising, will undoubtedly be number three, the third sort of triathlete.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about the Chinese randos? Have we seen the last of them? 2 years ago, there was like a lot of buzz and chatter, and you even sold a company helped sell a company to a Chinese equity.
That was
volcano. There's this idea that there's all this funny money and like volcanoes of cash.
Yeah, that was sort of an unnatural scenario where the primary motivation from those Chinese companies was multiple arbitrage, financial arbitrage.
Yeah, right.
So, that didn't feel sustainable, you know, at the time, and we weren't counting on it. And sure enough, with the Trump administration, that's largely
Fair enough. I felt like it was worth mentioning at least. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about GDPR and the impact there, because I think there has been a clear impact from a standpoint of our coverage, we've seen a lot of companies dropping their European businesses, for example, mm-hmm. in the programmatic space, ad tech space. And there's a real question about the future of user-level targeting. We've seen some of that and, early indications that contextual advertising may be seeing a comeback.
Right.
And, you referenced earlier how when you started Luma, you saw a real opportunity for kind of almost a reset in how the marketing and advertising industries work. It's no longer going to be about targeting vast audiences based on GRP-type metrics. It's going to be about efficient targeted buys, reaching people who are known entities, sometimes linked to a customer file.
Right.
And so GDPR is kind of throwing all that into question, and I'm curious what larger impact you see from that. And, you already sort of said it's kind of cooling the interest somewhat as large strategics, maybe even PE guys, decide to take a wait-and-see approach.
Yep.
What other impacts do you see?
So it's useful to put this in some context, right? I mean, we talk, and again, in our State of Digital Media report, about these sort of 10 issues, challenges to the digital supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last year and a half, Mark Pritchard from P&G has been sort of going around to conferences, talking about these issues and saying, hey, man, we got to have some trust and we got to solve some of these issues, otherwise there's going to be implications. Later in the year, we then saw implications, right? Pull back and spend.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other implications. Companies like, SAB bought Gigya for an identity solution.
Mm-hmm.
Oracle bought Grapeshot and Moat. So M&A was, in fact, a solution to sort of develop these capabilities to help address these problems.
Right.
This issue of privacy is, I would declare, in a different category altogether, existential almost, in terms of the threat to this 20-year trend towards making the targeting more finite, right? I mean, even contextual buys, if you buy on a particular, a car enthusiast website, you're targeting, right? You're mm-hmm. targeting on the basis of the likely audience of that website being interested in cars.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a crude form of targeting, just like the way Agent Demo is a crude form of targeting. And so, all of this data collection and data utilization was meant to increase relevancy. And the problem, I think, the fundamental problem, is that the value proposition to the end consumer hasn't been felt.
Right.
So we talk in the industry.
But Terry, the ads are so relevant.
Yeah, and nobody goes around saying that. I think on a B2B basis, right, everyone's convinced, why would you waste money with the wrong audience? And this totally makes sense. To the consumer, though, they're like, yeah, I don't really feel it. And in fact, if there's any impact of targeting, it's sort of retargeted ads for things they've already bought, which ends up being annoying,
right?
So so the consumers haven't felt it. But on the flip side, I am not convinced that and by the way, I'm a firm believer that you cannot violate people's privacy. If you're doing something that people don't like, you cannot do that. You cannot violate the principle of the consumer. And the Cambridge Analytica scandal was so extreme a case, because not only did you have Facebook sort of and others usurped data without people's permission.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. But then they utilized it for nefarious purposes, right? Circumventing democracy. So that was like a double whammy that everyone would say, no, that is wrong. The question is, privacy regulators have taken a stand saying, I don't think people like their anonymous data collected for purposes of targeted advertising. I'm not sure that's true.
Right.
I'm not sure they're sure. I'm sure it's important for them. So the privacy advocates are saying that. When I talk to younger people in particular, they're like, yeah, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't want it to be utilized improperly. They don't want you to, and some things are creepy and spooky, and people's practices, shouldn't go that far. But just for purposes of, knowing that, you are, 35 to 45-year-old male that lives in Manhattan mm-hmm. and has an interest in bubblegum. Right, I mean, do people take offense to that?
On
aspect?
Some level, European regulators have identified like anonymous cookie-based data collection as being a culprit in creating harm for the end user of the internet. I think part of what's happening is some of these regulators look at the billions and billions of dollars of valuation for U.S.-based companies and say, well, they've been able to do that on the back of our citizens' data. And there really isn't meaningful consent. And I actually agree with, I don't think there ever has been meaningful consent.
I agree.
In terms of internet data collection. And I think this regulation in particular is getting us some steps closer to that. And unfortunately, some of the impact is negative on end users. Some people are finding themselves blocked from visiting U.S. websites because U.S. publishers don't want to take any risks with the European audience. Well, okay, thanks, regulator. You just sort of degraded the quality of my media environment. And I'm sure there's a little bit of anger felt by citizens of the EU when they realize that the impact of this is actually negative for them.
And, you know, look, it does throw a wrench in the cog of the fundamental monetization of much of the internet, which is advertising.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, you know, it was hilarious to see our senators and congressmen in sort of shock and amazement that Facebook and many of the other sort of media companies out there, in fact, make their money and provide those said services and
Senator,
content.
We sell advertising.
Exactly, because of advertising.
So what's the upshot? There's a chill.
So immediately, there's just this great unknown, right? Because what we know is it was implemented on May 25th, and we know the penalties. We kind of don't know anything else. We don't know whether this notion of relying on legitimate interest is valid. We don't know the mechanisms for consent. We don't know what the consent adoption will look like. In particular, think about consent adoption, right? That is based on a value proposition. So if you're in the EU and there's a website that you go to, The Economist, all the time, and you like it and you enjoy it, you know, odds are you're going to opt in when you get that first notice. Same thing for the big platforms like Facebook and Google, because they're providing a service without charging for said service, and it's pretty clear. The problem is the serendipitous, you know, showing up on a publisher's website maybe you don't have a relationship with, you may not agree to. And besides, it's going to be a nightmare. Every new website, you have to give permissions, and then they can't keep a cookie, so they don't know which permissions you've given. So I don't know. The applications of it may have been well intended, but I think the applications are going to be challenging. And then the biggest unknown is enforcement. I mean, look, in the EU, the antitrust laws are very unified, right? Marguerite Vestager is the woman in charge of that, and she's done a very, you know, organized job of creating policy and enforcing, but it's centralized and unitary, you know, in Brussels. GDPR on the e-privacy stuff is completely the opposite. In fact, not only is it not every nation has their own enforcement, even within nations, Germany has 16 different, you know, provinces or groups that will in fact look at this for enforcement. And that's just going to create a ton of uncertainty.
Right.
In the long run, I actually see some benefits to GDPR, and hopefully it gets sort of sorted out, which is one of the things that marketers and publishers should be doing anyways, which is getting closer to their consumers, right? You see this, you know, incredible success of these direct-to-consumer brands garnering massive amounts of market share in relatively, you know, short periods of time by taking a very sort of sophisticated data-centric approach and having a direct relationship with their consumers. So, you know, we've been talking about, you know, the drive towards first-party data for a long time. I think this accelerates that. We've talked about sort of, you know, consolidation being needed in an overly fragmented universe. I think this accelerates that, some of which will be negative. But those in the long run will accrue to the benefit of the ecosystem writ large.
There's a couple of trends that seem to suggest innovation in marketing technology is kind of shifting towards the marketer. I think of this new CDP category, customer data platforms, which is kind of all the all the rage at the moment, and right. Blockchain, which a lot of that appears to be about illuminating the supply chain further and helping the marketer like understand where their money's going and track every dollar. Do you see a lot? Is this exciting to you?
Yes.
These two categories?
Well, let's talk about that. So I think this notion of the continuation of the trend line that we've been on, which mm-hmm. is identifying users and helping to improve, you know, marketing by targeting them by being omni-channel and hopefully improving the value proposition. We've talked a long time about that advertising is too interruptive mm-hmm. and needs to be a little bit more facilitative. Mm-hmm. So the value exchange is deemed to be different on behalf of the consumer. But yeah, there are technologies that take into account the rise of mobile, the mobile channel, which, you know, heretofore, right, a lot of the technologies we've used for identity and marketing automation have been based on desktop. So now when you account for the fact that people are on multiple devices, you need capabilities that, you know, can identify these people, allow the marketer to then message to them, again, on an omni-channel basis, whether it's email, what have you, and get them in the fold, you know, make mm-hmm. them part of the CRM or the first-party sort of data system. That manifests itself with, you know, CDPs and other companies that are sort of CDP-like, I would say. Another category that's exciting is the television market, all yeah. becoming sort of digitally addressable with OTT and addressable TV. Mm-hmm. That's exciting because it's a large market that currently spend goes in a
do you
completely
see,
different
do you see
direction.
Kind of a thousand flowers blossoming in TV ad tech? It feels to me like it's a smaller set of vendors.
Smaller set of vendors, which is good.
Yeah.
Let's not repeat what we did in display, right? That was not good. And when I say, you know, look, a lot of these companies are going to die like at a 90% rate or something like that, the pushback I get is, yeah, but isn't that every tech category? Mm. And I said, that may well be, but in ad tech, you get a unique situation of false positives. Mm. So if I'm selling software, right, and I got $25 million in software sales, I got something. I got something of value, right? People are stepping up to create budget for up to $25 million, so they're getting value out of that. There are ad tech companies with 25, 50, 100, 150 million in revenue that are not sustainable.
Right.
Why? Because they're just taking a piece of a massive amount of spend that's flowing through the system. Mm-hmm. So I think there's going to be rationalization. There's new categories like CTV and CDP and the whole sort of identity space. Then there's this sort of, you know, really, really new stuff. And I put three sort of elements in that category. One is audio, what we're doing right now. You know, you had a sponsor message earlier. Right. It's extremely effective. I'm not sure it's going to scale the same sort of rates as TV or display or search or anything like that. But it's a valuable one. And by the way, the flip side of audio is voice, right? And we're mm-hmm. just now learning the ramifications in terms of what Amazon's doing and Google and everyone else is doing, mm-hmm. you know, in the home and navigation for TV and all kinds of things. Yeah. So that's exciting. You've got AI, which we sort of view as sort of like Intel Inside. I mean, I hope so, right? We should be deploying AI, but I don't think consumers are going to see that, right?
Right.
I mean, that
does,
should
does
just
it
be...
Does it feeling like AI is really going to be owned by the really enormous platform companies?
Yeah,
I mean, there are...
It should be owned by many, right? So almost everyone should have some element of AI or machine learning that's driving their algorithms and businesses. So I think that's going to be pretty universal. So I'm not... You know, yes, it's important, but I'm not sure it's a category of companies that are, I'm an AI company.
I see. It's pervasive, right.
It's going to be pervasive. And then the third is blockchain. And look... My struggle with so blockchain, obviously, distributed ledger has the potential, but I guess what I struggle with is the use cases.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said, well, fraud. I'm like, okay, walk me through how a distributed ledger fixes the fraud problem. Mm-hmm. And I've heard the pitches.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of wait and see. I'm not holding my breath for a lot of these.
Mm-hmm.
I think blockchain writ large, you know, outside of advertising, has enormous potential implications.
Right.
I think it's sort of sad that today all we hear about is sort of, cryptocurrency speculation that tends to drive 95% of the, you know, talk about blockchain, which is unfortunate.
Right. To me, the most interesting use case that's actually live for blockchain is just turning it into PayPal for the marketing industry. just a visible payment system that brands can.
Yeah, the odd thing about blockchain is I keep hearing large companies come out and announce their blockchain initiative. Wait a second.
Yeah.
Proprietary blockchain? Doesn't that actually run in the face of the whole concept?
Good point.
Yeah.
So, well, what a treat. We're going to have to leave it there. But thank you, Terry, so much for coming into the studio.
Great to be here, Zach.
Thank you, listener. We'll see you next week.
Stay tuned next week to hear more conversations with Tealium. Visit Tealium.com/AdExchanger to learn more about how Tealium is helping companies intelligently orchestrate customer data. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.